The Winter Market, narrated by L.J. Ganser.
It rains a lot up here. There are winter days when it doesn't really get light at all, only a bright, indeterminate gray. But then there are days when it's like they whip aside a curtain to flash you 3 minutes of sunlit, suspended mountain, the trademark at the start of God's own movie. It was like that the day her agents phoned, from deep in the heart of their mirrored pyramid on Beverly Boulevard, to tell me she'd merged with the net, crossed over for good, that Kings of Sleep was going triple platinum. I'd edited most of Kings, done the brain map work, and gone over it all with the fast wipe module, so I was in line for a share of royalties. "No," I said, "no." Then, "yes, yes," and hung up on them. Got my jacket and took the stairs three at a time, straight out to the nearest bar and an 8-hour blackout that ended on a concrete ledge 2 meters above midnight. False creek water. City lights, that same gray bowl of sky smaller now, illuminated by neon and mercury vapor arcs. And it was snowing. Big flakes, but not many. And when they touched black water, they were gone. No trace at all. I looked down at my feet and saw my toes clear of the edge of concrete, the water between them. I was wearing Japanese shoes, new and expensive. Glove leather Ginza monkey boots with rubber-capped toes. I stood there for a long time before I took that first step back. Because she was dead, and I'd let her go. Because now she was immortal, and I'd helped her get that way. And because I knew she'd phone me in the morning. My father was an audio engineer, a mastering engineer. He went way back in the business, even before digital. The processes he was concerned with were partly mechanical, with that clunky, quasi-Victorian quality you see in 20th-century technology. He was a lathe operator, basically. People brought him audio recordings, and he burned their sounds into grooves on a disc of lacquer. Then the disc was electroplated and used in the construction of a press that would stamp out records, the black things you see in antique stores. And I remember him telling me once, a few months before he died, that certain frequencies, transients, I think he called them, could easily burn out the head, the cutting head, on a master lathe. These heads were incredibly expensive, so you prevented burnouts with something called an accelerometer. And that was what I was thinking of as I stood there, my toes out over the water, that head burning out. Because that was what they did to her. And that was what she wanted. No accelerometer for Lisa. I disconnected my phone on my way to bed. I did it with the business end of a West German studio tripod that was going to cost a week's wages to repair. Woke some strange time later and took a cab back to Granville Island and Reuben's place. Reuben, in some way that no one quite understands, is a master, a teacher, what the Japanese call a sensei. What he's the master of, really, is garbage, kipple, refuse, the sea of cast-off goods our century floats on. Gomi no sensei, master of junk. I found him, this time, squatting between two vicious-looking drum machines I hadn't seen before, rusty spider arms folded at the hearts of dented constellations of steel cans, fished out of Richmond dumpsters. He never calls the place a studio, never refers to himself as an artist. Messing around, he calls what he does there, and seems to view it as some extension of boyhood's perfectly bored backyard afternoons. He wanders through his jammed, littered space, a kind of mini-hanger cobbled to the waterside of the market, followed by the smarter and more agile of his creations, like some vaguely benign Satan bent on the elaboration of still stranger processes in his ongoing inferno of Gomi. I've seen Reuben program his constructions to identify and verbally abuse pedestrians wearing garments by a given season's hot designer. Others attend to more obscure missions, and a few seem constructed solely to deconstruct themselves with as much attendant noise as possible. He's like a child, Reuben. He's also worth a lot of money in galleries in Tokyo and Paris. So I told him about Lisa. He let me do it, get it out, then nodded. "I know," he said. "Some CBC creep phoned 8 times. He sipped something out of a dented cup. "You want a wild turkey sour? Why'd they call you?" "'Cause my name's on the back of Kings of Sleep. Dedication. I didn't see it yet." "She try to call you yet?" "No." "She will." "Reuben, she's dead. They cremated her already." "I know," he said. "And she's going to call you." Gomi. Where does the Gomi stop and the world begin? The Japanese, a century ago, had already run out of Gomi space around Tokyo, so they came up with a plan for creating space out of Gomi. By the year 1969, they had built themselves a little island in Tokyo Bay, out of Gomi, and christened it Dream Island. But the city was still pouring out its 9,000 tons per day, so they went on to build New Dream Island. And today they coordinate the whole process, and new Nippons rise out of the Pacific. Reuben watches this on the news and says nothing at all. He has nothing to say about Gomi. It's his medium, the air he breathes, something he's swum in all his life. He cruises Greater Van in a spavined truck thing chopped down from an ancient Mercedes airporter, its roof lost under a wallowing rubber bag, half filled with natural gas. He looks for things that fit some strange design scrawled on the inside of his forehead by whatever serves him as muse. He brings home more Gomi, some of it still operative, some of it, like Lisa, human. I met Lisa at one of Reuben's parties. Reuben had a lot of parties. He never seemed particularly to enjoy them himself, but they were excellent parties. I lost track that fall of the number of times I woke on a slab of foam to the roar of Reuben's antique espresso machine, a tarnished behemoth topped with a big chrome eagle, the sound outrageous off the corrugated steel walls of the place, but massively comforting, too. There was coffee. Life would go on. First time I saw her, in the kitchen zone. You wouldn't call it a kitchen exactly. Just 3 fridges and a hot plate, and a broken convection oven that had come in with the Gomi. First time I saw her, she had the all-beer fridge open, light spilling out, and I caught the cheekbones and the determined set of that mouth. But I also caught the black glint of polycarbonate at her wrist, and the bright, slick sore the exoskeleton had rubbed there. Too drunk to process, to know what it was, but I did know it wasn't party time. So I did what people usually did, to Lisa, and clicked myself into a different movie. Went for the wine instead, on the counter beside the convection oven. Never looked back. But she found me again. Came after me 2 hours later, weaving through the bodies and junk with that terrible grace programmed into the exoskeleton. I knew what it was then as I watched her homing in, too embarrassed now to duck it, to run, to mumble some excuse and get out. Pinned there, my arm around the waist of a girl I didn't know, while Lisa advanced, was advanced, with that mocking grace. Straight at me now, her eyes burning with whiz, and the girl had wriggled out and away in a quiet social panic, was gone. And Lisa stood there in front of me, propped up in her pencil-thin polycarbon prosthetic. Looked into those eyes, and it was like you could hear her synapses whining, some impossibly high-pitched scream, as the whiz opened every circuit in her brain. "Take me home," she said. And the words hit me like a whip. I think I shook my head. "Take me home." There were levels of pain there, and subtlety, and an amazing cruelty. And I knew then that I'd never been hated, ever, as deeply or thoroughly as this wasted little girl hated me now. Hated me for the way I'd looked, then looked away, beside Reuben's all-beer refrigerator. So, if that's the word, I did one of those things you do and never find out why. even though something in you knows you could never have done anything else. I took her home. I have two rooms in an old condo rack at the corner of 4th and McDonald, 10th floor. The elevators usually work, and if you sit on the balcony railing and lean out backward, holding on to the corner of the building next door, you can see a little upright slit of sea and mountain. She hadn't said a word, all the way back from Rubens, and I was getting sober enough to feel very uneasy as I unlocked the door and let her in. The first thing she saw was the portable fast wipe I had brought home from the pilot the night before. The exoskeleton carried her across the dusty broadloom with that same walk, like a model down a runway. Away from the crash of the party, I could hear it click softly as it moved her. She stood there, looking down at the fast wipe. I could see the thing's ribs when she stood like that, make them out across her back through the scuffed black leather of her jacket. One of those diseases. Either one of the old ones they've never quite figured out, or one of the new ones. The all-too-obviously environmental kind, that they've barely even named yet. She couldn't move, not without that extra skeleton. And it was jacked straight into her brain. Myo-electric interface. The fragile-looking polycarbon braces moved her arms and legs, but a more subtle system handled her thin hands, galvanic inlays. I thought of frog legs twitching in a high school lab tape, then hated myself for it. "This is a fast wipe module," she said, in a voice I hadn't heard before, distant, and I thought then that the whiz might be wearing off. "What's it doing here?" "I edit," I said, closing the door behind me. "Well, now," and she laughed. "You do. Where?" "On the island, place called the Automatic Pilot." She turned. Then, hand on thrust hip, she swung. It swung her. And the whiz and the hate and some terrible parody of lust stabbed out at me from those washed-out gray eyes. "You want to make it, editor?" And I felt the whip come down again. But I wasn't going to take it, not again. So I cold-eyed her from somewhere down in the beer-numb core of my walking, talking, live-limbed and entirely ordinary body, and the words came out of me like spit. "Could you feel it if I did?" Beat. Maybe she blinked, but her face never registered. "No," she said. "But sometimes I like to watch." Reuben stands at the window, 2 days after her death in Los Angeles, watching snow fall into False Creek. "So you never went to bed with her?" One of his push-me-pull-yous, little roller-bearing Escher lizards, scoots across the table in front of me, in curl-up mode. "No," I say, and it's true. Then I laugh. "But we jacked straight across, that first night." "You were crazy," he said, a certain approval in his voice. "It might have killed you. Your heart might have stopped. You might have stopped breathing." He turns back to the window. "Has she called you yet?" We jacked, straight across. I'd never done it before. If you'd asked me why, I would have told you that I was an editor and that it wasn't professional. The truth would be something more like this. In the trade, the legitimate trade, I've never done porno. We call the raw product dry dreams. Dry dreams are neural output from levels of consciousness that most people can only access in sleep. But artists, the kind I work with at the Autonomic Pilot, are able to break the surface tension, dive down deep, down and out, out into Jung's sea, and bring back, well, dreams. Keep it simple. I guess some artists have always done that, in whatever medium. But neuroelectronics lets us access the experience, and the net gets it all out on the wire, so we can package it, sell it, watch how it moves in the market. Well, the more things change. That's something my father liked to say. Ordinarily, I get the raw material in a studio situation, filtered through several $1 million worth of baffles, and I don't even have to see the artist. The stuff we get out to the consumer, you see, has been structured, balanced, turned into art. There are still people naive enough to assume that they'll actually enjoy jacking straight across with someone they love. I think most teenagers try it once. Certainly it's easy enough to do. Radio Shack will sell you the box and the trodes and the cables. But me? I'd never done it. And now that I think about it, I'm not so sure I can explain why, or that I even want to try. I do know why I did it with Lisa. Sat down beside her on my Mexican futon and snapped the optic lead into the socket on the spine, the smooth dorsal ridge of the exoskeleton. It was high up at the base of her neck, hidden by her dark hair. Because she claimed she was an artist, and because I knew that we were engaged somehow in total combat, and I was not going to lose. That may not make sense to you, but then you never knew her, or know her through Kings of Sleep, which isn't the same at all. You never felt that hunger she had, which was pared down to a dry need, hideous in its singleness of purpose. People who know exactly what they want have always frightened me, and Lisa had known what she wanted for a long time, and wanted nothing else at all. And I was scared then of admitting to myself that I was scared. And I'd seen enough strangers' dreams in the mixing room at the autonomic pilot to know that most people's inner monsters are foolish things, ludicrous in the calm light of one's own consciousness. And I was still drunk. I put the trodes on and reached for the stud on the fast wipe. I'd shut down its studio functions, temporarily converting $80,000 worth of Japanese electronics to the equivalent of one of those little Radio Shack boxes. "Hit it," I said, and touched the switch. Words. Words cannot. Or maybe just barely, if I even knew how to begin to describe it, what came up out of her, what she did. There's a segment on Kings of Sleep. It's like you're on a motorcycle at midnight. No lights, but somehow you don't need them. Blasting out along a cliff-high stretch of coast highway. So fast that you hang there in a cone of silence. The bike's thunder lost behind you. Everything lost behind you. It's just a blink on Kings. But it's one of the thousand things you remember, go back to, incorporate into your own vocabulary of feelings. Amazing. Freedom and death, right there. Right there. Razor's edge, forever. What I got was the Big Daddy version of that. Raw rush. The King Hell Killer uncut real thing, exploding eight ways from Sunday into a void that stank of poverty and lovelessness and obscurity. And that was Lisa's ambition, that rush, seen from the inside. It probably took all of 4 seconds. And, of course, she'd won. I took the trodes off and stared at the wall, eyes wet, the framed posters swimming. I couldn't look at her. I heard her disconnect the optic lead. I heard the exoskeleton creak as it hoisted her up from the futon. Heard it tick demurely as it hauled her into the kitchen for a glass of water. Then I started to cry. Reuben inserts a skinny probe in the roller-bearing belly of a sluggish push-me-pull-you and peers at the circuitry through magnifying glasses with miniature headlights mounted at the temples. "So? You got hooked?" He shrugs, looks up. It's dark now and the twin tensor beams stab at my face, chill damp in his steel barn, and the lonesome hoot of a foghorn from somewhere across the water. "So?" My turn to shrug. I just did. There didn't seem to be anything else to do. The beams duck back to the silicon heart of his defective toy. "Then you're okay. It was a true choice. What I mean is, she was set to be what she is. You had about as much to do with where she's at today as that fast wipe module did. She'd have found somebody else if she hadn't found you." I made a deal with Barry, the senior editor. Got 20 minutes at 5 on a cold September morning. Lisa came in and hit me with that same shot, but this time I was ready, with my baffles and brain maps, and I didn't have to feel it. It took me 2 weeks, piecing out the minutes in the editing room, to cut what she'd done down into something I could play for Max Bell, who owns the pilot. Bell hadn't been happy. Not happy at all, as I explained what I'd done. Maverick editors can be a problem, and eventually most editors decide that they've found someone who'll be it, the next monster, and then they start wasting time and money. He'd nodded when I'd finished my pitch, then scratched his nose with the cap of his red felt pen. Uh-huh, got it. Hottest thing since fish grew legs, right? But he'd jacked it, the demo soft I'd put together, and when it clicked out of its slot in his brawn desk unit, he was staring at the wall, his face blank. Max? Huh? What do you think? Think? What did you say her name was? He blinked. Lisa? Who you say she signed with? Lisa. Nobody, Max. She hasn't signed with anybody yet. Jesus Christ. He still looked blank. You know how I found her? Reuben asks, wading through ragged cardboard boxes to find the light switch. The boxes are filled with carefully sorted gomi. Lithium batteries, tantalum capacitors, RF connectors, breadboards, barrier strips, ferro-resonant transformers, spools of bus bar wire. One box is filled with the severed heads of hundreds of Barbie dolls. Another with armored industrial safety gauntlets that look like spacesuit gloves. Light floods the room, and a sort of Kandinsky mantis in snipped and painted tin swings its golf ball-size head toward the bright bulb. I was down Granville on a gomi run, back in an alley, and I found her just sitting there. Caught the skeleton, and she didn't look so good, so I asked her if she was okay. Nothing. Just closed her eyes. Not my lookout, I think. But I happened back by there about 4 hours later, and she hasn't moved. Look, honey, I tell her. Maybe your hardware's buggered up. I can help you, okay? Nothing. How long you been back here? Nothing. So I take off. He crosses to his workbench and strokes the thin metal limbs of the mantis thing with a pale forefinger. Behind the bench, hung on damp, swollen sheets of ancient pegboard, are pliers, screwdrivers, tie-wrap guns, a rusted Daisy BB rifle, coax strippers, crimpers, logic probes, heat guns, a pocket oscilloscope, seemingly every tool in human history, with no attempt ever made to order them at all, though I've yet to see Reuben's hand hesitate. So I went back, he says. Gave it an hour. She was out by then, unconscious, so I brought her back here and ran a check on the exoskeleton. Batteries were dead. She'd crawled back there when the juice ran out and settled down to starve to death, I guess. When was that? About a week before you took her home. But what if she died, if you hadn't found her? Somebody was going to find her. She couldn't ask for anything, you know. Just take. Couldn't stand a favor. Max found the agents for her, and a trio of awesomely slick junior partners leered into YVR a day later. Lisa wouldn't come down to the pilot to meet them, insisted we bring them up to Reuben's, where she still slept. "Welcome to Cooverville," Reuben said as they edged in the door. His long face was smeared with grease. The fly of his ragged fatigue pants held more or less shut with a twisted paper clip. The boys grinned automatically, but there was something marginally more authentic about the girl's smile. "Mr. Stark," she said. "I was in London last week. I saw your installation at the Tate." "Marcello's battery factory," Reuben said. "They say it's scatological, the Brits." He shrugged. "Brits. I mean, who knows?" "They're right. It's also very funny." The boys were beaming like tabled, tanned lighthouses, standing there in their suits. The demo had reached Los Angeles. They knew. "And you're Lisa," she said, negotiating the path between Reuben's heaped gomi. "You're going to be a very famous person soon, Lisa. We have a lot to discuss." And Lisa just stood there, propped in polycarbon. And the look on her face was the one I'd seen that first night in my condo when she'd asked me if I wanted to go to bed. But if the junior agent lady saw it, she didn't show it. She was a pro. I told myself that I was a pro, too. I told myself to relax. Trash fires gutter in steel canisters around the market. The snow still falls and kids huddle over the flames like arthritic crows, hopping from foot to foot, wind whipping their dark coats. Up in Fairview's arty slum tumble, someone's laundry has frozen solid on the line. Pink squares of bedsheet standing out against the background dinge, and the confusion of satellite dishes and solar panels. Some ecologist's egg-beater windmill goes round and round, round and round, giving a whirling finger to the hydro rates. Reuben clumps along in paint-spattered L.L. Bean gumshoes, his big head pulled down into an oversized fatigue jacket. Sometimes one of the hunched teens will point him out as we pass. The guy who builds all the crazy stuff, the robots and shit. "You know what your trouble is?" he says when we're under the bridge, headed up to 4th. "You're the kind who always reads the handbook. Anything people build, any kind of technology, it's going to have some specific purpose. It's for doing something that somebody already understands. But if it's new technology, it'll open areas nobody's ever thought of before. You read the manual, man, and you won't play around with it, not the same way. And you get all funny when somebody else uses it to do something you never thought of, like Lisa." She wasn't the first. Traffic drums past overhead. "No, but she sure as hell the first person you ever met who went and translated themselves into a hardwired program. You lose any sleep when, what's his name did it, 3-4 years ago? The French kid? The writer?" I didn't really think about it much. A gimmick. PR. "He's still writing. The weird thing is, he's gonna be writing, unless somebody blows up his mainframe." I wince, shake my head. "But it's not him, is it? It's just a program." "Interesting point. Hard to say. With Lisa, though, we find out. She's not a writer." She had it all in there, Kings, locked up in her head the way her body was locked in that exoskeleton. The agents signed her with a label and brought in a production team from Tokyo. She told them she wanted me to edit. I said no. Max dragged me into his office and threatened to fire me on the spot. If I wasn't involved, there was no reason to do the studio work at the pilot. Vancouver was hardly the center of the world, and the agents wanted her in Los Angeles. It meant a lot of money to him, and it might put the autonomic pilot on the map. I couldn't explain to him why I'd refused. It was too crazy, too personal. She was getting a final dig in. Or that's what I thought then. But Max was serious. He really didn't give me any choice. We both knew another job wasn't going to crawl into my hand. I went back out with him, and we told the agents that we'd worked it out. I was on. The agents showed us lots of teeth. Lisa pulled out an inhaler full of whiz and took a huge hit. I thought I saw the agent lady raise one perfect eyebrow, but that was the extent of censure. After the papers were signed, Lisa more or less did what she wanted. And Lisa always knew what she wanted. We did Kings in 3 weeks, the basic recording. I found any number of reasons to avoid Reuben's place, even believed some of them myself. She was still staying there, although the agents weren't too happy with what they saw as a total lack of security. Reuben told me later that he'd had to have his agent call them up and raise hell, but after that they seemed to quit worrying. I hadn't known that Reuben had an agent. It was always easy to forget that Reuben Stark was more famous then than anyone else I knew, certainly more famous than I thought Lisa was ever likely to become. I knew we were working on something strong, but you never know how big anything's liable to be. But the time I spent in the pilot, I was on. Lisa was amazing. It was like she was born to the form, even though the technology that made that form possible hadn't even existed when she was born. You see something like that and you wonder how many thousands, maybe millions of phenomenal artists have died mute down the centuries. People who could never have been poets or painters or saxophone players, but who had this stuff inside, these psychic waveforms waiting for the circuitry required to tap in. I learned a few things about her, incidentals from our time in the studio. That she was born in Windsor, that her father was American and served in Peru, and came home crazy and half blind. That whatever was wrong with her body was congenital. That she had those sores because she refused to remove the exoskeleton, ever, because she'd start to choke and die at the thought of that utter helplessness. That she was addicted to whiz and doing enough of it daily to wire a football team. Her agents brought in medics, who padded the polycarbon with foam and sealed the sores over with micropore dressings. They pumped her up with vitamins and tried to work on her diet, but nobody ever tried to take that inhaler away. They brought in hairdressers and makeup artists, too, and wardrobe people and image builders and articulate little PR hamsters, and she endured it with something that might almost have been a smile. And right through those 3 weeks, we didn't talk. Just studio talk, artist, editor stuff, very much a restricted code. Her imagery was so strong, so extreme, that she never really needed to explain a given effect to me. I took what she put out and worked with it, and jacked it back to her. She'd either say yes or no, and usually it was yes. The agents noted this and approved, and clapped Max Bell on the back and took him out to dinner, and my salary went up. And I was pro, all the way, helpful and thorough and polite. I was determined not to crack again, and never thought about the night I cried. And I was also doing the best work I'd ever done, and I knew it. And that's a high in itself. And then one morning, about 6, after a long, long session, when she'd first gotten that eerie cotillion sequence out, the one the kids call the ghost dance, she spoke to me. One of the two agent boys had been there, showing teeth. But he was gone now, and the pilot was dead quiet, just the hum of a blower somewhere down by Max's office. "Casey," she said, her voice hoarse with the whiz. "Sorry I hit on you so hard." I thought for a moment she was telling me something about the recording we'd just made. I looked up and saw her there, and it struck me that we were alone, and hadn't been alone since we'd made the demo. I had no idea at all what to say. Didn't even know what I felt. Propped up in the exoskeleton, she was looking worse than she had that first night at Rubens. The whiz was eating her under the stuff the makeup team kept smoothing on, and sometimes it was like seeing a death's head surface beneath the face of a not very handsome teenager. I had no idea of her real age. Not old, not young. "The ramp effect," I said, coiling a length of cable.
"What's that?"
"Nature's way of telling you to clean up your act. Sort of mathematical law, says you can only get off real good on a stimulant X number of times, even if you increase the doses. But you can't ever get off as nice as you did the first few times, or you shouldn't be able to anyway. That's the trouble with designer drugs. They're too clever. That stuff you're doing has some tricky tail on one of its molecules. Keeps you from turning the decomposed adrenaline into adrenochrome. If it didn't, you'd be schizophrenic by now. You got any little problems, Lisa, like apnea? Sometimes maybe you stop breathing if you go to sleep?" But I wasn't even sure I felt the anger that I heard in my own voice. She stared at me with those pale gray eyes. The wardrobe people had replaced her thrift shop jacket with a butter-tanned matte black blousen that did a better job of hiding the polycarbon ribs. She kept it zipped to the neck, always, even though it was too warm in the studio. The hairdressers had tried something new the day before, and it hadn't worked out. Her rough, dark hair, a lopsided explosion above that drawn, triangular face. She stared at me, and I felt it again, her singleness of purpose. "I don't sleep, Casey." It wasn't until later, much later, that I remembered she'd told me she was sorry. She never did again, and it was the only time I ever heard her say anything that seemed to be out of character. Reuben's diet consists of vending machine sandwiches, Pakistani takeout food, and espresso. I've never seen him eat anything else. We eat samosas in a narrow shop on 4th that has a single plastic table wedged between the counter and the door to the can. Reuben eats his dozen samosas, 6 meat and 6 veggie, with total concentration, one after another, and doesn't bother to wipe his chin. He's devoted to the place. He loathes the Greek counterman. It's mutual, a real relationship. If the counterman left, Reuben might not come back. The Greek glares at the crumbs on Reuben's chin and jacket. Between samosas, he shoots daggers right back, his eyes narrowed behind the smudged lenses of his steel-rimmed glasses. The samosas are dinner. Breakfast will be egg salad on dead white bread, packed in one of those triangles of milky plastic, on top of 6 little cups of poisonously strong espresso.
"You didn't see it coming, Casey."
He peers at me out of the thumb-printed depths of his glasses.
"'Cause you're no good at lateral thinking. You read the handbook. What else did you think she was after? Sex? More whiz? A world tour? She was past all that. That's what made her so strong. She was past it. That's why Kings of Sleep's as big as it is, and why the kids buy it, why they believe it. They know. Those kids back down the market, warming their butts around the fires and wondering if they'll find some place to sleep tonight, they believe it. It's the hottest soft in 8 years. Guy at a shop on Granville told me he gets more of the damned things lifted than he sells of anything else. Says it's a hassle to even stock it. She's big because she was what they are, only more so. She knew man. No dreams, no hope. You can't see the cages on those kids, Casey. But more and more they're twigging to it that they aren't going anywhere. He brushes a greasy crumb of meat from his chin, missing 3 more. So she sang it for them. Said it that way they can't. Painted them a picture. And she used the money to buy herself a way out. That's all. I watch the steam bead roll down the window in big drops, streaks in the condensation. Beyond the window, I can make out a partially stripped Lada, wheels scavenged, axles down on the pavement. How many people have done it, Reuben? Have any idea? Not too many. Hard to say anyway, because a lot of them are probably politicians we think of as being comfortably and reliably dead.
He gives me a funny look. Not a nice thought.
Anyway, they had first shot at the technology. It still costs too much for any ordinary dozen millionaires, but I've heard of at least 7. They say Mitsubishi did it to Weinberg before his immune system finally went tits up. He was head of their hybridoma lab in Okayama. Well, their stock's still pretty high in monoclonals, so maybe it's true. And Langlais, the French kid, the novelist, he shrugs. Lisa didn't have the money for it. Wouldn't now, even. But she put herself in the right place at the right time. She was about to croak. She was in Hollywood, and they could already see what Kings was going to do.
The day we finished up, the band stepped off a JAL shuttle out of London. 4 skinny kids who operated like a well-oiled machine and displayed a hypertrophied fashion sense and a total lack of affect. I set them up in a row at the pilot, in identical white IKEA office chairs, smeared saline paste on their temples, taped the trodes on, and ran the rough version of what was going to become Kings of Sleep. When they came out of it, they all started talking at once, ignoring me totally, in the British version of that secret language all studio musicians speak, 4 sets of pale hands zooming and chopping the air. I could catch enough of it to decide that they were excited, that they thought it was good. So I got my jacket and left. They could wipe their own saline paste off, thanks. And that night, I saw Lisa for the last time, though I didn't plan to. Walking back down to the market, Reuben noisily digesting his meal, red taillights reflected on wet cobbles, the city beyond the market a clean sculpture of light, a lie.
where the broken and the lost burrow into the gomi that grows like humus at the bases of the towers of glass. I gotta go to Frankfurt tomorrow, do an installation. You wanna come? I could write you off as a technician. He shrugs his way deeper into the fatigue jacket. Can't pay you, but you can have airfare you want. Funny offer from Reuben. And I know it's because he's worried about me, thinks I'm too strange about Lisa, and it's the only thing he can think of, getting me out of town. It's colder in Frankfurt now than it is here. You maybe need a change, Casey. I don't know. Thanks, but Max has a lot of work lined up. Pilot's a big deal now, people flying in from all over. Sure. When I left the band at the pilot, I went home. Walked up to 4th and took the trolley home, past the windows of the shops I see every day. Each one lit up jazzy and slick, clothes and shoes and software. Japanese motorcycles crouched like clean enamel scorpions. Italian furniture. The windows change with the seasons. The shops come and go. We were into the pre-holiday mode now, and there were more people on the street. A lot of couples, walking quickly and purposefully past the bright windows, on their way to score that perfect little whatever for whomever. Half the girls in those padded thigh-high nylon boot things that came out of New York the winter before. The ones that Reuben said made them look like they had elephantiasis. I grinned, thinking about that. And suddenly it hit me that it really was over. That I was done with Lisa. And that now she'd be sucked off to Hollywood as inexorably as if she'd poked her toe into a black hole, drawn by the unthinkable gravitic tug of big money. Believing that she was gone, probably was gone by then, I let down some kind of guard in myself and felt the edges of my pity. But just the edges, because I didn't want my evening screwed up by anything. I wanted party time. It had been a while. Got off at my corner and the elevator worked on the first try. Good sign, I told myself. Upstairs, I undressed and showered, found a clean shirt, microwaved burritos. Feel normal, I advised my reflection while I shaved. You have been working too hard. Your credit cards have gotten fat. Time to remedy that. The burritos tasted like cardboard, but I decided I liked them because they were so aggressively normal. My car was in Burnaby, having its leaky hydrogen cell repacked, so I wasn't going to have to worry about driving. I could go out, find party time, and phone in sick in the morning. Max wasn't going to kick. I was his star boy. He owed me. You owe me, Max, I said to the Sub-Zero bottle of Moskovskaya I fished out of the freezer. Do you ever owe me? I have just spent 3 weeks editing the dreams and nightmares of one very screwed-up person, Max, on your behalf, so that you can grow and prosper, Max. I poured 3 fingers of vodka into a plastic glass left over from a party I'd thrown the year before, and went back into the living room. Sometimes it looks to me like nobody in particular lives there. Not that it's that messy. I'm a good, if somewhat robotic, housekeeper, and even remember to dust the tops of framed posters and things. But I have these times when the place abruptly gives me a kind of low-grade chill, with its basic accumulation of basic consumer goods. I mean, it's not like I want to fill it up with cats or houseplants or anything, but there are moments when I see that anyone could be living there, could own those things. And it all seems sort of interchangeable. My life and yours, my life and anybody's. I think Reuben sees things that way too, all the time, but for him it's a source of strength. He lives in other people's garbage, and everything he drags home must have been new and shiny once, must have meant something, however briefly, to someone. So he sweeps it all up into his crazy-looking truck and hauls it back to his place, and lets it compost there until he thinks of something new to do with it. Once he was showing me a book of 20th-century art he liked, and there was a picture of an automated sculpture called Dead Birds Fly Again, a thing that whirled real dead birds around and around on a string. And he smiled and nodded, and I could see he felt the artist was a spiritual ancestor of some kind. But what could Reuben do with my framed posters, and my Mexican futon from the bay, and my temper foam bed from IKEA? Well, I thought, taking a first chilly sip, he'd be able to think of something, which was why he was a famous artist, and I wasn't. I went and pressed my forehead against the plate glass window, as cold as the glass in my hand. "Time to go," I said to myself. "You are exhibiting symptoms of urban singles angst. There are cures for this. Drink up. Go." I didn't attain a state of party time that night. Neither did I exhibit adult common sense and give up, go home, watch some ancient movie, and fall asleep on my futon. The tension those 3 weeks had built up in me drove me like the mainspring of a mechanical watch, and I went ticking off through Nighttown, lubricating my more or less random progress with more drinks. It was one of those nights, I quickly decided, when you slip into an alternate continuum, a city that looks exactly like the one where you live, except for the peculiar difference that it contains not one person you love or know or have even spoken to before. Nights like that, you can go into a familiar bar and find that the staff has just been replaced. Then you understand that your real motive in going there was simply to see a familiar face on a waitress or a bartender, whoever. This sort of thing has been known to mediate against party time. I kept it rolling, though, through 6 or 8 places, and eventually it rolled me into a West End club that looked as if it hadn't been redecorated since the 90s. A lot of peeling chrome over plastic, blurry holograms that gave you a headache if you tried to make them out. I think Barry had told me about the place, but I can't imagine why. I looked around and grinned. If I was looking to be depressed, I'd come to the right place. Yes, I told myself as I took a corner stool at the bar, this was genuinely sad, really the pits. Dreadful enough to halt the momentum of my shitty evening, which was undoubtedly a good thing. I'd have one more for the road, admire the grot, and then cab it on home. And then I saw Lisa. She hadn't seen me, not yet, and I still had my coat on, tweed collar up against the weather. She was down the bar and around the corner with a couple of empty drinks in front of her. Big ones, the kind that come with little Hong Kong parasols or plastic mermaids in them. And as she looked up at the boy beside her, I saw the whiz flash in her eyes and knew that those drinks had never contained alcohol because the levels of drugs she was running couldn't tolerate the mix. The kid, though, was gone. Numb, grinning, drunk, and about ready to slide off his stool, and running on about something as he made repeated attempts to focus his eyes and get a better look at Lisa, who sat there with her wardrobe team's black leather blouson zipped to her chin, and her skull about to burn through her white face like a 1,000-watt bulb. And seeing that, seeing her there, I knew a whole lot of things at once. That she really was dying, either from the whiz or her disease, or the combination of the two, that she damned well knew it, that the boy beside her was too drunk to have picked up on the exoskeleton, but not too drunk to register the expensive jacket and the money she had for drinks, and that what I was seeing was exactly what it looked like. But I couldn't add it up right away, couldn't compute. Something in me cringed. And she was smiling. Or anyway, doing a thing she must have thought was like a smile. The expression she knew was appropriate to the situation, and nodding in time to the kid's slurred inanities, and that awful line of hers came back to me, the one about liking to watch. And I know something now. I know that if I hadn't happened in there, hadn't seen them, I'd have been able to accept all that came later. Might even have found a way to rejoice on her behalf, or found a way to trust in whatever it is that she's since become, or had built in her image, a program that pretends to be Lisa to the extent that it believes it's her. I could have believed what Reuben believes, that she was so truly past it, our high-tech Saint Joan burning for union with that hard-wired godhead in Hollywood, that nothing mattered to her except the hour of her departure, that she threw away that poor, sad body with a cry of release, free of the bonds of polycarbon and hated flesh. Well, maybe after all, she did. Maybe it was that way. I'm sure that's the way she expected it to be. But seeing her there, that drunken kid's hand in hers, that hand she couldn't even feel, I knew, once and for all, that no human motive is ever entirely pure. Even Lisa, with that corrosive, crazy drive to stardom and cybernetic immortality, had weaknesses, was human in a way I hated myself for admitting. She'd gone out that night, I knew, to kiss herself goodbye, to find someone drunk enough to do it for her, because I knew then it was true. She did like to watch. I think she saw me as I left. I was practically running. If she did, I suppose she hated me worse than ever for the horror and the pity in my face. I never saw her again. Someday I'll ask Reuben why wild turkey sours are the only drink he knows how to make. Industrial strength, Reuben's Sours. He passes me the dented aluminum cup while his place ticks and stirs around us with the furtive activity of his smaller creations. "You ought to come to Frankfurt," he says again. "Why, Reuben?" "Because pretty soon she's going to call you up, and I think maybe you aren't ready for it. You're still screwed up about this, and it'll sound like her and think like her, and you'll get too weird behind it. Come over to Frankfurt with me, and you can get a little breathing space. She won't know you're there." "I told you," I say, remembering her at the bar in that club. "Lots of work. Max..." "Stuff, Max! Max, you just made rich. Max can sit on his hands. You're rich yourself from your royalty cut on Kings, if you weren't too stubborn to dial up your bank account. You can afford a vacation." I look at him and wonder when I'll tell him the story of that final glimpse. "Reuben, I appreciate it, man. But I just..." He sighs, drinks. "But what?" "Reuben, if she calls me, is it her?" He looks at me a long time. God only knows. His cup clicks on the table. "I mean, Casey, the technology is there, so who, man? Really, who is to say? And you think I should come with you to Frankfurt?" He takes off his steel-rimmed glasses and polishes them inefficiently on the front of his plaid flannel shirt. "Yeah, I do. You need the rest. Maybe you don't need it now, but you're going to later." "How's that?" "When you have to edit her next release, which will almost certainly be soon because she needs money bad. She's taking up a lot of ROM on some corporate mainframe, and her share of Kings won't come close to paying for what they had to do to put her there. And you're her editor, Casey. I mean, who else?" And I just stare at him as he puts the glasses back on, like I can't move at all. "Who else, man?" And one of his constructs clicks right then, just a clear and tiny sound. And it comes to me, he's right.